where they were. America is a great country, he'd always add. Once we reached Las Vegas, we always went to the Stardust. There, my father would go to the front desk and ask for a special friend, a man who had asked to be called Al. Despite the no vacancy sign, the mighty Al would get us a room. This clandestine operation, however, required a handshake with a $5 bill enclosed. My father loved his Frank Sinatra moment and always told stories about the exchanges between him and Al, stretching a 5-minute encounter into a 2-hour story. I hated Al and always hoped he'd end up in jail. But he, like the decks of cards adorned with pictures of naked women, was a fixture at the Stardust. Years later, I asked my father why he never made room reservations in advance. That would have been too boring, he said. Once we settled into our room, my father headed straight for the blackjack tables. Everyone, except gamblers, knows that gambling never pays. My father always believed that he was this close to the big one. But because of some unforeseen event, like someone else winning, he'd lost. Losing, like winning, only increased his determination to play. At the blackjack table, my father became strangely superstitious, blaming his losses on seemingly unrelated events. He never sat at a table where anyone wore a hat, since that was bad luck. Redheads were good luck, but only if they were women. Redheaded men were bad luck. People who talked too much were bad luck, as were people who were strangely silent. My favorite of his wacky beliefs was that non-Americans at the table were bad luck. I couldn't resist suggesting that maybe he should stay home, since as a foreigner, he was his own biggest source of bad luck. My father never appreciated that observation. A few hours after our arrival, my mother would declare that it was time to go find my father. Minors were not allowed in the gambling area, so like moons orbiting the Earth, we circled the perimeter of the casino, looking for my father's signature receding hairline. During our many revolutions, we noticed a correlation between receding hairlines and blackjack, as well as a relationship between outdated bouffant hairdos and slot machines. Once we'd spotted him, I'd wait near the main entrance while my mother went to fetch him. My father considered the sight of my mother approaching him to be a certain sign of bad luck. It was then time for the $3.99 all-you-can-eat buffet, during which we unfortunately had to listen to my father's gambling stories. These didn't change much from trip to trip and involved a lot of almosts. I hated these stories as much as I hated Al, because I'd figured out that nobody leaves Las Vegas a winner. The all-you-can-eat buffet, that American phenomenon, represented the only endurance exercise at which my family excelled. Even when my father had just lost hundreds of dollars at the blackjack table, we felt that we were beating the system by filling ourselves with more food than we were actually paying for. "These shrimp alone are worth at least $5," my father would declare. "Look at those desserts. They're worth the price of the buffet by themselves," my mom and I would chime in. By stuffing ourselves until we ached, we felt we had outsmarted Las Vegas, and all for only $3.99. What made Las Vegas even more awful were my memories of real vacations we had taken in the past. In Iran, vacation meant going to the Caspian Sea. Every summer, my father's employer, the National Iranian Oil Company, allowed its employees the use of its villas in Mahmudabad for 1 week. Mahmudabad, a town on the Caspian shore, was a 2-day drive from Abadan. Every summer, the five of us would pile into our Chevrolet, my mom making sure to bring enough sandwiches, cucumbers, fruit, and Coca-Cola for the long drive. We were always glad to leave Abadan in the summer, since its desert climate was unbearable. As we headed north toward Tehran, the weather cooled off slowly, proof that we were indeed farther and farther from our home. We always reached Tehran in the evening and spent the night at relatives' houses. The next morning, we set off again, complete with fresh sandwiches and fruit, courtesy of my relatives. The drive between Tehran and the Caspian Sea is one of the most beautiful stretches of land I have ever seen. The lush scenery offered more shades of green than I saw anywhere else. We passed by endless fields of purple wildflowers. The most exciting part of the trip was the many tunnels, which enabled us to pass through the Alborz Mountains to reach the Caspian. We knew we were almost there by the change in the climate. The closer we came, the fresher and crisper the air. The sight of villagers hawking cheap plastic pails, beach balls, and shell necklaces along the road meant one thing. We were almost at the sea. We could no longer contain our excitement. The villas we stayed in were modest cabins lined up along the beach like dominoes. Days were spent at the beach where we built sandcastles, looked for seashells, and played in the waves. Knowing the children were safely occupied, my parents relaxed and mingled with friends. Meals were eaten in the mess hall, cafeteria style. At night, everyone returned to the cafeteria for the nightly movie. In retrospect, our vacation was like a family camp, and everyone was sad to leave. How can a week go by so quickly? We'd always ask. In America, we lived on the California coast, but rarely went to the beach. The water was too cold and the waves too big. Longing for warm water one year, we decided to vacation in Hawaii. My father booked a one-week stay in Waikiki. "We're staying right on the beach," he announced. Having never been to Hawaii, I expected a relaxing tropical paradise, somewhere like Gilligan's Island. We arrived in Waikiki to discover that an ocean view room meant we had to stand on our balcony and crane our necks to catch a speck of blue in the far corner. In between the high-rises sat shops declaring, "I got laid in Hawaii," on t-shirts, mugs, and towels. Everywhere I went, I saw the same carved coconuts, the same seashell frames, and the same hats, all made in the Philippines. I tried to hang loose, but Waikiki felt more like 7-Eleven by the sea. The following year, we decided to vacation on Kauai, an island in Hawaii that the travel agent described as a true tropical paradise. The description was accurate. Our one-story hotel sat in the middle of a lush forest. On our first day, we experienced quick tropical rains followed by spectacular rainbows. Vibrant flowers, so big and rich in color that they almost looked fake, dotted the plants around our hotel. We had found God's hideaway. On our second day, my parents announced that Kauai was boring. "There's nothing to look at, just plants and rainbows," my father declared. "There are no stores," added my mother. Instead of staying for another week, we left the next day. The following year, my father decided to take us to Yosemite National Park for a week. Uncle Nematola was staying with us then. My father booked two cabins, and off we went for another taste of paradise. 8 hours later, we arrived in the beautiful Yosemite Valley. We oohed and awed at the spectacular scenery. The first day, we explored the surrounding area, wading in a nearby stream. All was perfect until my uncle, who didn't speak English but who could nonetheless identify a picture of a bear's head with a line through it, asked my father to translate the signs posted near our cabin. My father explained that the signs warned campers of bears that often came looking for food. Upon hearing this, my mother and uncle decided we had to leave Yosemite right away. My mother was convinced that the bears were lined up in the nearby bushes waiting for their chance at the all-you-can-eat Persian buffet. "We can't leave," I protested. "We just got here." My mother was already packing the suitcases. I tried my best to reason with her. "The signs say that the bears are attracted by the smell of food, not people." An hour later, we were in the car, headed for the bear-free suburbs. After that trip, my father declared that with the sole exception of Las Vegas, his favorite vacation spot was right here on the sofa in front of the television set. My mother declared that my father was a bore. And I decided that as soon as I was grown up, I would travel the world looking for rainbows and bears. But before that, I'd have to see Al one more time so I could suggest a great vacation spot for him. "Just keep plenty of food on you at all times," I'd tell him, "especially when you sleep." Of mosquitoes and men. My husband Francois loves to travel. When I first met him, he regaled me with stories of exotic places he had visited: the Maldives Islands, West Africa, Bali, Sri Lanka. He told me stories about his Greek grandfather, Savas, who traveled to Baghdad to set up the city's first leavened bread factory. A few months after his arrival, he suffered a minor cut during his daily shave. The seemingly innocuous cut became infected. Penicillin had not yet reached Baghdad, and Sevas died a few days later, leaving behind a wife and two young daughters. In keeping with local tradition, Sevas was buried in a Muslim ceremony. A few nights later, François' Belgian grandmother, Octavie, went to the gravesite at midnight with two young men, a Roman Catholic priest, and a shovel. She had her husband dug up, then reburied in a Catholic ceremony. Before Baghdad, Sevas and Octavie had lived in the Congo, where Octavie had a beloved baby buffalo. This gentle creature hung around their home like a family pet. But like all buffalo, he eventually grew big and turned into the proverbial bull in the china shop. Having been domesticated, he could no longer be returned to the wild, so Octavie decided to send him to the zoo in Antwerp. After a teary goodbye, she placed the buffalo on a steamship bound for Belgium. But alas, the zoo never received its newest addition. Somewhere between the Congo and Belgium, the cook had developed a hankering for buffalo stew. François also told me that when he first attended kindergarten in Paris, his teacher called his parents after a week to inform them that their son was exhibiting inappropriate behavior and needed to see a psychologist immediately. Apparently, François was unable to keep his clothes on at school. His mother had to explain that having spent his formative years in Africa, he wasn't used to wearing clothes. Given time, she said, he would surely adjust. I loved all of François' stories and never had to impress him with any exotic tales, since as far as he was concerned, being Iranian and having a name like Firouzeh far outweighed any of his adventures. I didn't quite agree with him, but who was I to burst the bubble of a man whom I had somehow managed to effortlessly impress? A man who was captivated by the mere details of my life. Every so often, I would toss out some piddly story about the caviar vendors beside the Caspian Sea, or the smell of nasturtiums in my Aunt Sadira's garden, and the Frenchman went gaga. By the time I told him about the frog infestation in Ahvaz, he wanted to marry me. All was well until we started to plan our honeymoon. François had told me that he wanted to take me to the most romantic place on earth. That sounded good. We're going to go to a former palace, he had continued. Was this really my life, or had I, through some wrinkle in time, stepped into somebody else's universe, like maybe Grace Kelly's? But like every good fantasy, this one lasted about 30 seconds. That's when François told me that this romantic getaway was in India. I tried to conceal my shock, but for me, India and honeymoon just didn't belong in the same sentence. As much as I love Indian music, literature, and food, I had never felt the need to go there on my honeymoon. I feel about India the way I feel while watching those Jacques Cousteau adventures where the divers explore undersea caves, flashing their lights in the pitch-black crevices, only to discover that the cave is teeming with sharks and giant squid. Yes, it's breathtaking, but from my sofa. Do I want to don a wetsuit and join Jacques in those frigid waters? No merci. François was very disappointed that several weeks of planning had been met with, "Are you kidding?" I tried to explain to him that for me, a vacation does not involve certain hardships, including, but not limited to, mosquitoes, vaccinations, poor plumbing, or stomach ailments. Having grown up in southern Iran, I experienced enough physical discomforts to make me truly appreciate a nice resort. François's life of affluence in the Parisian suburbs, on the other hand, had left him itching for adventure. The only itching I felt was caused by the constant mosquito bites I got in Abadan. To François's family, a vacation meant going to their secluded seaside villa in Greece, where they brushed up on their tanning and windsurfing skills. These activities were interspersed with fishing or looking for ancient relics that washed up on the beach. To my family, a vacation usually meant going to a relative's house and sleeping on the floor, squeezed between several cousins. François enjoyed traveling through Greece on rickety buses, such a refreshing contrast to the orderly and predictable Parisian metro. I had to ride a similar bus to school in fourth grade, and I found it neither quaint nor charming. Ignoring any notions of safety, the bus driver packed in twice as many kids as seats. Since I was one of the last to be picked up, I had to stand in the aisle, squeezed between the other kids like an egg in a tightly packed tin of beluga caviar. One day, the girl behind me threw up all over me on the way to school. The driver kept driving. By the time I reached school, I was in tears, but the teacher would not let me go home. I had to spend the entire day with dried vomit all over my uniform while all the kids around me held their noses. During other vacations, Francois saw the sights in Thailand and Bali, the only sights we ever chose to see were the faces of family members who lived in other towns. Francois's family thought large bugs and humidity were exotic. We worshipped the guys who invented climate control and bug spray. We never sought exotic forms of discomfort. They were part of a package deal that came with our homeland. I remember being 5 years old and going to the bazaar in Abadan with my mother and needing desperately to go to the bathroom. The only bathrooms available were Turkish ones, which consist of a hole in the ground. If odor could be measured in decibels, these toilets were the equivalent of front row seats at a heavy metal concert. Needless to say, I just couldn't get myself to use any of them. Besides setting a bladder endurance record, I learned never to drink anything on the morning of bazaar day. As much as I loved living in Abadan, I hated the heat and the mosquitoes. If everyone has a lifetime quota of bug bites, I reached mine by age 6. My father used to tell me that I must be the sweetest person because the mosquitoes bit me more than anyone else. The constant itching combined with the oppressive heat made me truly appreciate modern touches like powerful air conditioners and screen doors. When we came to California, one of the first things I noticed was the pleasant absence of mosquitoes. After almost 2 delightful mosquito-free years in Whittier, we returned to Iran. My mother and I went to live in Ahvaz with my aunt Fatime, while my father worked in Tehran. Ahvaz in southern Iran is a town generously endowed with dirt and dust. Everything that moved on the unpaved streets, whether people, donkeys, or cars, only served to relocate the dirt from the ground to the face of anyone who happened to be walking down the same path. It rarely rained, but when it did, the dirt became mud, and mud on the face is far more annoying than dirt. I was slow to adjust to my new, more physically challenging surroundings. Just when I was getting used to the taste of dust in my mouth, along came a frog infestation of biblical proportions. Tiny frogs covered the town. The streets undulated under a blanket of frogs. Before we entered any building, we had to scrape off the layer of sticky frog guts clinging to our shoes. No matter how quickly we opened and closed the front door of our house, 5 or 6 frogs managed to hop in. We always found the intruders eventually, but in the most unlikely places. I never quite got used to hearing my mother scream, "How did the frog get in there?" This went on for a couple of weeks until the frogs mysteriously disappeared and frog innards were, thankfully, no longer a part of my daily life. The next time I saw frogs close up, I was on my honeymoon in Paris. Francois and I were staying in a beautiful hotel with great plumbing and no mosquitoes. This time, the frogs were not covering the bottom of my shoe, but instead were covered with a light persillade and came with a side of asparagus. They were much better that way. The F word. My cousin's name, Farbod, means greatness. When he moved to America, all the kids called him Farthead. My brother, Farshid, he who enlightens, became Fartshit. The name of my friend Negar means beloved, although it can be more accurately translated as she whose name almost incites riots. Her brother, Arash, giver, initially couldn't understand why every time he'd say his name, people would laugh and ask him if it itched. All of us immigrants knew that moving to America would be fraught with challenges, but none of us thought that our names would be such an obstacle. How could our parents have ever imagined that someday we would end up in a country where monosyllabic names reign supreme, a land where William is shortened to Bill, where Susan becomes Sue, and Richard somehow evolves into Dick? America is a great country, but nobody without a mask and a cape has a Z in his name. And have Americans ever realized the great scope of the guttural sounds they're missing? Okay, So it has to do with linguistic roots. But